All right, guys, you may be seated. I want to invite you to turn in your Bible to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 12 is where we're going to pick up. But I want to backtrack just a bit because the section we're looking at tonight is so short and it's so directly connected to the opening verses we covered last week. This whole chapter is on the theme of resurrection, and we know this. This is a broken record at this point. 1 Corinthians is written to address problems, and we've gone over problem after problem in this book. The problem of schisms, the problem of incest, the problem of immorality, of prostitution, of marriage and divorce. We've looked at the problems of the abuse of the Lord's Supper and the abuse of spiritual gifts. Again and again, Paul wants to hone in on significant problems that are plaguing this young church he planted just 3 to 4 years earlier. But the biggest problem for him is the Corinthians' denial of the resurrection. And that's why he leaves this problem for the last. And we looked at this last week as we discovered Paul's going to address this denial, but he's going to address it by first proclaiming very clearly that this is what they are grounded on. This gospel of Christ being died and then being risen is at the core, the foundation of what he's preached, what they stand on, and what they are meant to continue in. And so I want to read verses 1 through 11. We covered this last week in detail, but just to give you the backdrop for the section we're going to be covering tonight, verses 12 through 19. Paul writes, "Now I would remind you, brothers and sisters, of the good news that I proclaimed to you, which in turn you received, in which you also stand, through which you are also being saved, if you hold firmly to the message that I proclaimed to you, unless you've come to believe in vain. For I handed on to you as of first importance," nothing is more important than this, "what I in turn had received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers and sisters at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have died. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. For I am the least of the apostles, unfit to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace toward me has not been in vain. On the contrary, I worked harder than any of them, though it was not I, but the grace of God that is with me. Whether then it was I or they, so we preach, and so you've come to believe." And now our new verse, "Now if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there's no resurrection of the dead?" In 1977, Marvel Comics came out with a series called What If. What If was all about what if significant points in Marvel's history had not occurred? How would the timeline change? How would things be different? And you have from 1977 to 2008 a series of comics with titles like, in the middle, "What If Jane Foster Had Found the Hammer of Thor?" That wouldn't be too awful different. We'd just have a female Thor instead of a male Thor. There's another issue, "What If Loki had found the hammer of Thor?" And that'd be all kinds of trouble. "What if Dr. Doom had become a hero? What if Hulk had the brain of Bruce Banner?" For a little kid like me that loved comics, this was a treat and a delight because you were used to the normal history, the normal story. But this turned the normal story on its head and asked you to consider, what if these events that are so significant to your understanding of the story of the Marvel Universe, what if they hadn't happened and things were completely different? It's that very question that Paul's going to address in verse 13. If there's no resurrection of the dead, what if? What if Christ has not risen from the dead? What does that do to the gospel that we've preached, that you've received, that you stand in? What does it do to that if we change that point in history, if we make it a different story? So that in the section we're about to cover, Paul's not going to do anything to try to prove the resurrection. Indeed, he never tries to prove it. He always just simply proclaims it. But he's going to ask the question, what if it did not occur? And he's going to give them a devastating reality check of the consequences of rejecting the resurrection of Christ. He's going to pull no punches. He's going to give them an alternate history of things and how things would be if Christ had not risen. And he's doing this because some are denying the resurrection. And that perhaps is the most curious thing for anyone reading this in verse 12. If Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say there's no resurrection from the dead? Clearly, some in the Corinthian community were denying or rejecting or questioning or having troubles with the idea of bodily resurrection. Well, that's not unusual. That's been the case ever since it's happened. In our day, there are reasons why people might deny the resurrection. We have certain cultural influences that make it hard for us to believe in the resurrection of Christ. We have things like our Enlightenment rationalism, which gives a priority over reason, which declares that there can't be any real unique event with continuing significance. Everything must be something to be tested and evaluated and happen again and again and again. We have materialism, which would suggest, you know, we're just molecules in motion. There's really no soul or spirit. Our brain's just secreting thoughts. There's nothing really there beyond just your body. And if your body dies, that's all that there is. There's nothing beyond that. Those are influences we have from our culture, but none of these would be influences for the Corinthian community. This isn't how they thought. This isn't the world they lived in. They had other cultural influences that were challenging their belief in the resurrection of Christ. I want to note just two of them. One of them is Epicureanism. The other one is Neoplatonism. Epicureanism is not nearly as pervasive as the second we'll look at, Neoplatonism. They had an Epicureanism. There were just a few, and obviously this had some impact on the Corinthian community. Epicureanism simply said, yes, there is a soul and there is a body, but when the body dissolves, the soul ceases to exist. You don't exist anymore. It's over. So the only real life that you'll ever know is the short span you have between your birth and your death, because there's nothing after that. We have from archaeology numerous tombstones. And you would know that someone is an Epicurean if on their epitaph of their tombstone they'd have the words non few, few, non sum, non curo, which translates, I wasn't, I was, I am not, I don't care. Now, you can actually see that on the tombstone here. You see the N. Let's see if I can get my... Oh, no. My run. There it is. You see the NF? This doesn't show up on the screen. I can't point to things on the screen. That's the first problem I have with this screen. You can see the NF. You see that? On the far left, in the middle, NS, non sum, and then the NC, non curo. This was such a common epitaph that it was abbreviated just like our RIP, rest in peace. It was something that people, they just could see the initials, they knew what it meant, and this was clearly an Epicurean. They were someone who believed that the soul dissolves with the body. There is nothing beyond that. And of course, with that Epicureanism came the idea that if this life is all you have, then you better eat, drink, and be merry. You better pursue it for all the gusto it can give you, because you only get one chance at this thing, and you better pursue your happiness first and foremost. None of that sacrificing for others, you know, maybe just a little if it makes you happy, but your happiness is what matters most, and you need to pursue your own pleasure, your own happiness, because there's going to come a time when you will simply cease to be. Now, this was a smaller cultural influence. The much more pervasive influence that would lead the Corinthians to wrestle with bodily resurrection is something we've already addressed and something we've seen that's already influenced our Corinthian church, and that's Neoplatonism. And simply put, this idea that the soul is immortal, it's the gem, it's the diamond, but it's encaged by this body. And the body, being the prison house of the soul, is something that eventually the soul will discard, and it will be immortal without all the hindrances and problems that come with the body. Now, you might find that not too hard to believe, because I'd suggest Neoplatonism lives very well in our modern world as well. As we talk about kind of a disembodied heaven and escaping from the body. But there's a problem with that, which we'll note here in just a moment, namely that creation is good. The body is good. that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. But one of the problems with Neoplatonism is if the body is a prison house for the soul, then you can tend to two extremes. And we've seen these extremes in the Corinthian community. You can indulge the body because whatever the body does, it doesn't have any impact on the diamond, on the immortal soul. And so you remember chapter 6, some of the Corinthians were indulging in prostitution, saying, hey, just food for the body, body for the food. The stomach needs some food. The body needs some sex. That's just how it works. It's just a desire. We got to satisfy it. That's how it works. It doesn't impact our spirituality. It has no significance on us altogether. It's just the body that's being impacted. So you can indulge it. And Paul says, hey, glorify God in your body. Then you could abstain or deny it in an attempt to be hyper-spiritual. And we saw that in 1 Corinthians 7. Some were denying sexual relations in marriage. Husbands and wives saying, nope, we're going to be super spiritual. No sex in marriage. That's how we're going to show how spiritual we are. Neoplatonism is deeply impacting the Corinthians and perhaps the whole ancient world. It's the dominant mentality and philosophy. And so you can kind of cut the Corinthians some slack. It's not so much that they were saying, like people in our day do, saying, you know, resurrection simply can't happen, so we're going to deny it. We're going to keep on believing the faith. I don't know why, but we'll keep believing it. But resurrection doesn't happen. They weren't that crass. They instead had a philosophy in their culture that made them think the body can't inhabit the celestial realm. The body's dirty. The body's a prison. The body must be discarded. It can't be transformed. It can't be redeemed. It's something that, you know, we just have to wrestle with until our immortal soul is released from the prison house, this cage that is our body. This is a problem for Paul because he knows his Jewish Christian tradition well. He knows Genesis 1 begins with God created and it's good. Mountains, seas, water, flesh. It's good. It's all very good. He knows that God desires not to eliminate creation, which includes our body, but to restore and transform it. He also knows that the Word was made flesh. That the very heart of his thinking is that Emmanuel has come. God has come into our world and completely inhabited a body. And that body wasn't discarded at the resurrection. It was transformed so that he remains fully human and fully divine. So he's aware that the Judeo-Christian tradition cannot in any way negate the body. The body matters. It's good. It is that which God has united God's self with eternally in the incarnation. And that's why he'll say things in 1 Corinthians like, glorify God in the body. Because for him, the body is not going to be erased. It's going to be renewed. It'll be restored. It'll be transformed. And because of that, he believes the things we do in this body have real significance. That they're not just negatable. They're not just things that you happen to do or you happen to not do. But what you do in the body has deep significance. That's why he's going to end this entire chapter with, you can see it at the end, you have to go to the very bottom of our right-hand page. This is ultimately his conclusion. Therefore, my beloved, be, and I need to hear pages turning, be steadfast, immovable, always excelling in the work of the Lord, because you know that in the Lord your labor, your present labor in the body is not in vain. It matters. And so for Paul, this is a deeply important issue. It's not so much that he's dealing with outright deniers of the resurrection. He's dealing with those who cannot see how the resurrection could be spiritual. How it could be anything good, because for them, spiritual means a rejection or denial of the body and not an affirmation of and a transformation of the body. And so with that said, that's the issue. It is there because of cultural influence, and he must address it, and that's what he's going to do in our section before us in verse 13 and forward. He's going to say, hey, I've been preaching the resurrection of the body. You guys at first believed it. You agreed to it. Some of you are denying it. Let me tell you what happens if there's no resurrection, or our Marvel series. What if there's no resurrection? And he's going to pull no punches. This is a dark passage. When you listen to the consequences that he's going to lay before you, you're going to realize that Paul is willing to take us to the devastating end of things. What if there's no resurrection? Here's the world he presents for us. Verse 13. If there's no resurrection of the dead, then Christ has not been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our proclamation, our kerygma, our preaching has been in vain, and your faith has been in vain. The word for vain is kenos. It means empty, hollow, meaningless. You could say a sham, a hoax. If Christ has not been raised, he says, you know what we've been preaching to you is an absolute sham. It is total phony baloney. And we are offering to a world that's suffering and challenged a pious lie. A pious lie that somehow Christ is risen when in fact his body rots in a tomb and there is no resurrection. So he says, first off, our preaching is in vain, and beyond that, it gets even worse. Verse 15, we are even found to be misrepresenting God. Misrepresenting is Paul's nice way of saying blaspheming. Speaking in God's name that which is not God's truth. We've been misrepresenting God because we testified of God that he raised Christ, whom God did not raise, if it is true that the dead are not raised. Are you all right? Was that a gunshot? Everyone okay? What was that? Okay, it's just a mistake. All right. No blood. We're all good. The apostles are false witnesses. Paul's willing to say, and he just said it in the opening paragraph that we read, that he and Cephas and James and all the apostles have been preaching the resurrection. That this is the message they preach. And he says, you know, if the resurrection isn't true, it's not just that what we preach is hollow. Every one of us are liars. We are false prophets. We've proclaimed that Christ is risen, but we're not trustworthy because we're charlatans willing to make false statements, to misrepresent God, to speak in God's name what we know is not true. He then moves on and says, verse 16, for if the dead are not raised, then Christ has not been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is empty, hollow, sham. And you're still in your sin. In other words, the power of sin and death is not broken. Death reigns supreme. Death overshadowed and destroyed Jesus and kept him there. That the greatest power is not the love of God. It's not the life of God. It is death. Death overshadows and destroys and undoes everything. Yes, Jesus lived righteously and justly. But guess what that kind of life gets you in the end? Nowhere. Because his body rots. It's a sham. He then moves on and says, if that's true, this does not bode well for those who've died in Christ already. Verse 18, then those also who've died in Christ have perished. All those words said of how they've fallen asleep, well, they haven't fallen asleep to rise again anew one day. They instead have perished forever. Because God's not greater than death. Death is a greater power than God. Divine love is not what is eternal. Death is what is eternal. So that he's just kind of, you know, he's putting the dagger in and he's twisting it and he's turning it because he wants to make it very clear there are significant consequences to saying that Christ hasn't risen. But I think the most challenging one for us to hear, and I think the hardest for us to believe, is the last one he's going to say. Verse 19, if for this life only we have hoped in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. Why would he say that? Well, Paul believes. He smokes what he sells. He believes it. He's willing to suffer. He's fought. He's died. He's been whipped. He's been imprisoned. He could be living such a wonderful, best life now, if not for Jesus. He has sacrificed so much, and many of the Corinthians are as well, because the call is to self-denial. It is called to self-sacrifice. It is a call to giving oneself for the good of others. And he says, you know, if this life is all there is, then I've really mismanaged my time here. He says, Christians aren't only bad off, they're worse off having believed. Because they've invested their lives in an illusion, in a deception. They have experienced and embraced suffering for nothing. They're missing out on their share of life's rewards. They could be relaxing, eating, drinking, being merry. Paul could be teaching. Paul could be doing so many other things. But instead, he has given himself utterly and completely to the point of, in the end, being willing to be beheaded, to lose his life for this thing. And he says, you know, I'm doing this because I recognize there is a hope to this life, that Christ has risen and thus all will rise in Christ. That means what I do in this body has significance insofar as it aligns with Christ and the hope that he brings. And I've invested myself so much, suffered so much. If I've only done it for this life only, and then I cease to be, then I've really wasted my time. How much better it would have been for me to indulge myself, or at least pursue my happiness. Pursue that which, you know, allows me to live a satisfying, contented life, not the challenging life that he, of course, experienced. So he is throwing all this out. He wants to paint the darkest picture possible because he's now going to turn the tables in verse 20, and we'll look at this next week. But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, so that even though these consequences are hard to hear, here's what makes them, I think, really exciting for me. If these are the consequences of what if Christ has not risen from the dead, then they are completely turned on their head when you say, but what if Christ has risen from the dead? So that all of these things are turned around. Preaching is not in vain. The gospel is true. The apostles aren't false witnesses. They are speaking faithfully with integrity the truth that they've experienced. Faith isn't futile. In fact, it is perhaps one of the most remarkable things there is, to trust in the God who has raised Christ from the dead. Dead believers aren't lost for good. They dwell in the presence of Christ, awaiting the resurrection that we will all experience. And the Christian life is not pathetic, something to be pitied. It actually is something noble. But he's going to go beyond all of that next week in one of the most elevated and wonderful passages about what it means if Christ has risen from the dead. And I wanted to reserve it for its own space because it is such a wonderful, powerful passage of a universal hope that is aspiring and inspiring in so many ways. And so we'll look at that next week. But this is Paul doing his best to give you the what if. What if Christ has not risen from the dead? Now, as always, I like to give you three reflections, and I want to give you three reflections just based on this short what if scenario that Paul presents. And the first one is, believe it or not, I believe in, and I think Paul believes in, a very reasonable faith. That's not to say God is bound to our reason, because if we believe in God at all, God always transcends our reason. God is beyond all thought, all comprehension, anything we can imagine. Our little 3 pounds of mush in our head cannot possibly comprehend the fullness and the greatness of God any more than I can comprehend the fullness and greatness of any one individual here this day. We multiply that by infinity and we realize there was always this awareness in Paul's thinking. We see but in a mirror darkly. There is always this awareness for Israel that God's name is Yahweh, I am that I am. There's no name that can be given. It's just, I am God. There was always this sense in the mystics, you read them in the medieval time, that God is beyond the cloud of unknowing. So your highest, most loftiest thought of God, realize that even that's a vain conceit and an idol, because you must go beyond even your loftiest concept of God, because God is beyond concept, beyond fathoming, beyond imagining. So there's always been that element in the Christian tradition, but it's always been accompanied with the fact that, faith is reasonable in this sense. Whatever claims are made, there are reasonable consequences to them. So that if Christ has raised, there's reasonable consequences. We'll look at those next week. If Christ has not raised, there are reasonable consequences to that, which Paul has just blatantly thrown before us with a dagger as well. So that when you think about it, Paul has said, hey, this is reasonable. I want to think about the consequences of the claims that we're making in this gospel, that Christ has died and Christ is risen. So that if these claims are not true, it's only reasonable that this is what we Christians are doing. We are blindly leaping off a chasm, imagining some wonderful thing that we can never really fall into because it's just a vain hope. Instead, we fall and plummet to our peril, never to be seen again. Paul said this in a way that's hard to hear because he's just flat out said, if Christ hasn't been risen, then what we do is a sham. It's phony. It's meaningless. It's empty. It's vain. The Christian religion is a circus sideshow without resurrection. At best, a distraction to keep us occupied. At worst, a horrible, horrible thing to place upon people because it is not true. So Paul wants to be reasonable. That's what is true if the resurrection has not occurred. But if it has occurred, then Paul also wants to be reasonable and say, if Christ has risen, then here's, dear Corinthians, what you're doing. Here's what you're doing with that which is of first importance. You are sawing off the branch that you sit on. You are knocking out the bottom of your faith. You are destroying the foundation upon which the very gospel stands, that Christ has died and Christ is risen. That if you believe in your heart that God hath raised him from the dead and declare Jesus as Lord, thou shalt be saved. That God has triumphed over death. That humanity has been restored in Christ. You're cutting all of that off. You're going to be, in just a bit, if you saw long enough, there on the floor, writhing. So he's very, very concerned. He doesn't want them to saw this branch off. And he is being reasonable about this. Now he's going to show, next week we'll see, that there's no reason to saw this branch off. If you leave it there, you'll realize how beautiful a picture of reality there is for us. For if the resurrection is true, here are all the good things that are also reasonably true. Second reflection, I think Paul's very, very clear that he believes there is such a thing as a delusional faith. He argues that the resurrection is so central that if it's lost, nothing remains. Which, this is where I'd want to apply this for you because I see this all the time. I just saw it last week on a Facebook interaction between a very deep and dear friend of mine where this friend was arguing Christ is risen and then someone got on like they always do on Facebook and you want to mess and pee on everyone's parade. That's how our social media works. Someone says something and you just got to tear it down. And then some other guy came on to defend my friend and said, you know what? Even if Christ wasn't risen from the dead, I'd still be a Christian. I'd still do what I'm doing. And I thought, you know, that's noble, I guess, but it's also delusional. I wouldn't. I wouldn't sacrifice. I would find a job where I wasn't overwhelmed by anxiety for the church and concern for the faith of God people. I would go and deliver pizzas. I would do something else because it's just not worth it. I'd find a place where I'd make enough money to live a reasonably happy life because at the end of the day, I, like you, have about 70 to 90 years and then it's over and nothing really will be remembered. No one's going to give it a second thought 20 years from then, 50 years, 100 years from then, just like I don't know my great-grandparents. It'll be largely irrelevant. And, you know, people will say, well, that sounds awful selfish. And I'd say, yeah, but who's in this world is to tell me I'm to seek some kind of greater good? There is no greater good. There's no greater good. There's a cold, lonely, empty universe where you're born, you die. You're a virus on the face of the earth. You're here for a moment. Might as well live it up. That seems to me to be a lot better life than spending and giving and praying and wrestling and working and trying to understand how God works in and through all the injustices and challenges, than trying to think about how my faith can stay and withstand when everything around me seems to suggest, nah, there's no reason to continue this faith. I wouldn't see any reason to fight the good fight of faith or to run the race or to keep the faith. I'd do what was in Rich's best interest, and it wouldn't be this. I'd sleep easier at night. So I think Paul has no part and would have no interest in someone who says, well, even if it's not true, I still would choose to believe in it. Well, that has as much validity as saying, live like a Jedi. Live like a Jedi. Make that your life's goal. Be a Jedi. It has just as much validity because they don't exist, people. I guess you'll have fun, but you're wasting your life in many ways, because that itself has no lasting significance. So Paul is more than willing to speak of a faith that's delusional. Then my third reflection is perhaps the one that most connects to what's going on here. It's interesting to me that the reason why the Corinthians had issues with the bodily resurrection had everything to do with their culture and the cultural influences that pervaded and surrounded them. Cultural influences that were so familiar to them, it's like water for a fish. They weren't even aware. Weren't even aware of how much their Neoplatonism was impacting them and making it difficult for them to embrace that the body could be spiritual, that it could be spiritually transformed, that it was anything but a prison house for the soul. And that's why I think we don't suffer from that same kind of Neoplatonism. We have it a little bit, and you'll see vestiges of it. No philosophy ever finally dies. They all move on and morph and become other things. And yet, I do think the cultural influences that we wrestle with are a little bit different. And in my thinking, one of the biggest ones is just simply the Enlightenment rationalism that we get from the 16th, 17th century, that comes from the idea that, you know, at the end of the day, reason is primary, and in order for me to believe something, I must observe it. I must be able to see it, and I need to learn with my observing that there are things that I must distrust if they are not likely to happen, which means I can't put any trust in a unique event that happens with continuing significance like the resurrection. Resurrection's not reasonable. That doesn't happen ordinarily and often. So it's more likely that instead of thinking resurrection happened, it's more likely that I've got a bunch of deceived people who think they experienced the resurrection. David Hume, the Scottish philosopher in the 18th century, wrote The Nature of Human Inquiry, and he's the one that really got the ball rolling on this. The idea that in his mind, Christianity was rooted in a miracle, but he did his best to pretty much define miracles out of existence in the name of reason. And this is perhaps the most important quote from his book. When anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately consider with myself whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be deceived, or the fact which he relates should really have happened. So, and he's right. In an ordinary course of things, if someone tells me, you know, they saw a unicorn, then I probably need to think, well, it's probably more likely that they're deceived, or they are deceiving, or that it just simply never happened. And with his philosophy, he ended up creating a situation where there could be no unique event that occurred with continuing significance, because that unique event needed to be replicated and re-experienced and done again and again, which then by default makes it not a unique event. It's an ordinary event. Now, his philosophy has taken a dive a little bit with postmodernity, because in 1917, we all embraced the idea that there can be a unique event without repetition that has continuing significance. You know what it is? Nope. But it's right around that time. You guys are in the right date period. 1917, Montaigne or something like that. But then you know the name Hubble. That 1927 was Montaigne, 1929 Hubble. And he realized that the universe is expanding. And you do realize it wasn't until 1927 that we had the Big Bang Theory. Prior to that, you have steady state. Not the TV show, as much fun as that is. But the Big Bang Theory proper. And in 1927, there was a scientist who was doing the first calculations, but Hubble's the one that could finally give scientific data to say, yes, the universe is expanding, so there must have been, if we calculate far enough back, a singularity, a unique moment that will not be replicated with continuing significance. And all of a sudden, with the birth of that and relativity and architecture and other things that come with postmodernity, the idea that you couldn't have a unique event with continuing significance, that it had to be something that, you know, was ordinary and obvious all the time, all of a sudden, we all now, for the most part, believe in a unique event with continuing significance. Which makes it not that hard for me to move and say, well, there can be unique events If the resurrection is true, that's a unique event, not to be replicated. It has continuing significance. It goes beyond just observing by reason alone and through my own empiricism and observation, but it does suggest that the world is in such structured in such a way that things can't happen that are so totally unique and yet have ramifications that continue on and they still remain reasonable. So when you think about this Enlightenment rationalism, one of the things that I have kind of kept in my brain is I love Blaise Pascal, who was wrestling with this in the 1600s, that at the end of the day, I believe in being reasonable, but I think that reason is not the highest. Faith, I don't think, is opposed to reason. But faith needs to be in dialogue with reason, and faith has things that it can communicate. Did you guys see that?
Yep.
Wow. I'm glad you all saw that. Faith has things that can communicate that cause us to transcend reason. Not to be irrational, but to be transrational. Not to be unreasonable, but to be transreasonable. Which I would assume you and I should be in agreement on, that if we're dealing with God, we are always going to go beyond reason. We're not going to be delusional. We're not going to be irrational. But we have to, if we're really dealing with God, the being beyond being, the one beyond concept, the unfathomable, then we must be willing to say, like Pascal said, it's only reasonable that human reason has its limits. In fact, it's only reasonable to admit that. And my guess is many who subscribe to Enlightenment rationalism aren't willing to say that. I am. God is able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond all that we ask or think or imagine. We see in a glass dimly. What awaits us, we just have no possible way of fathoming. We do our best to speak of it, to point of it. Paul's going to, in verse 35 and forward, try to use words to speak of the resurrection body. And he's going to give some metaphors that will push us in a right direction. But they'll never fully explain it because he knows himself that he's speaking of something that is beyond words, beyond fathoming. But that doesn't mean it's not true. For those bound to reason, it can't be true. For those who embrace the divine, an awareness that God is able to do exceedingly abundantly beyond, then perhaps a wonderful possibility. So when I hear that quote from Pascal, I always think of the quote from Shakespeare in Hamlet that I like to kind of throw at people. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Which is a way of saying there's more to this world than your 3 pounds of brain matter are able to process. And that's something I automatically assume when I think that I'm engaging with God. I do not assume that it will be something that can be completely contained in my reason. I always assume there will be a trans-rational, trans-reasonable quality to it, which is just another way to say, as the Bible does, mystery. That there will be a mystery to this. Not a mystery that can be solved, but a mystery that transcends even our rationing, reasoning. So, when you think about these things, we're always going to clash with culture. Materialism is another thing, but I don't want to spend any time on that. That's a predominant one in our day and age. Your brain is just secreting, you know, things. Consciousness, all of that can be explained by simple molecules in motion. There's no soul or spirit animating it. And in my mind, that's simply exposed by saying the Judeo-Christian tradition says we're made in the image of God. God's not just a rock that's thinking. You know, God is personal, transpersonal, beyond person. So that there is a sense in which to kind of reduce ourselves to just secretions and molecules and atoms already, in my mind, denies the Christian, Judeo-Christian tradition because we're made in the divine image. And yet, for that reason, many people will simply say, again, resurrection can't happen. Because we're going to always clash with culture, with what we believe, the Corinthians did with their Epicureanism and their Neoplatonism, we do with our rationalism, with our materialism, because that's always the case. I want you to take solace in this. Paul was always aware that there'd be this clash. That's why he began our book with a passage where he says, clash with culture? Yeah, I don't care. He says, we preach Christ crucified. It's a stumbling block to Jews. They can't deal with the dead Messiah. Messiah should be triumphant. And it is foolishness to Gentiles. Why is it foolish? Because the body is a prison house for the soul. Corpses don't rise. They're eliminated. They're erased. They're gotten rid of so that the immortal soul can carry on. He is well aware from the opening chapter of this book that he is directly confronting cultural influences. He is well aware of this, and he says, you know what? Here's what he'd say if he lived in our day and age. Well, I guess I'll accommodate the gospel so it's, you know, something that everyone can appreciate. But Paul says, I'm not going to accommodate. Not going to accommodate. It's foolishness. It's a stumbling block. Get over it. Embrace a new way of thinking. Understand what life is if there is a God who's made a good creation, who has given a Redeemer, who has inhabited a human body, who has died an unjust death and risen to life anew that all might rise in Him. You have a different story. You have a different culture. You have a different way of approaching things. And so he directly challenges without hesitation this Jewish stumbling block, the Gentile stumbling block, and says, yeah, it's a stumbling block, and it's going to remain that way because the gospel will demand it. The gospel will confront some of these shortcomings, which is a way of saying Paul knows that the gospel, and particularly the gospel of the resurrection, will not be easy to believe. It wasn't easy to believe for the Corinthians. It's not easy to believe for us. Everywhere it's met with doubt until finally the apostles and Paul and others say, yeah, I guess this thing has happened. Their lives are transformed and changed. Though they're slow to believe it, when they finally do believe it, it changes everything. Which is what you'd expect good news to do. It's what you'd expect the gospel to do. To change everything, including how we view life, ourselves, God, and the future, all of those things. And so that's our passage. Would you pray with me?